Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is the longest-serving leader in Israel's history. But nearly 6 months into Israel's war against Hamas, cracks have formed in the political coalition keeping him in power. On Thursday, Israel's Supreme Court issued a ruling that could imperil Netanyahu. It was about Israel's mandatory draft. Ultra-Orthodox Jews who study at religious schools have pretty much always been exempt from military service. But that protection is up in the air now. The court suspended government funding for those ultra-Orthodox students. And lawmakers missed today's deadline to pass a new law that would continue to protect the community from the draft.
It's a conflict that really goes back to the founding of Israel, and it's been a bubbling issue for so long within Israel and kind of gets at the heart of this kind of struggle between ultra-religious and secular in the country. You know, on October the 7th, we really had this sense of unity in the country and everyone coming together and sort of a hiatus from all these kind of fault lines that were existing before. But now we're really starting to see those bubble back again.
Loveday Morris is a foreign correspondent at The Post, and she has been reporting on the potential implications for Netanyahu. Last week's ruling has outraged ultra-Orthodox leaders.
Basically, within Netanyahu's ruling coalition, he relies on these ultra-Orthodox parties for support. And when he made this government, he gave them big promises of finding a new law that would satisfy their desires when it came to military service. And that's something that they're very anti because they see it as really a threat to their existence. In some ways, they're worried that men will go off and join the military and they'll be exposed to outside influences and potentially no longer be so religious. So they see it as a real existential issue. And yes, Netanyahu's reliant on them for their support.
From the newsroom of The Washington Post, this is Post Reports. I'm Martine Powers. It's Monday, April 1st. Today, Loveday explains the complicated political landscape that Netanyahu has to navigate in order to stay in power. And later in the episode, we'll talk about the protests over the last few days in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, where tens of thousands of people have been calling for new elections. So, Loveday, tell me more about the military draft in Israel and, like, how it works, why it's such a big deal in this country.
Well, so every young Israeli 18-year-old comes out of school and has to do military service. For men, that's almost 3 years. For women, that's 2 years. It's part of what every Israeli does, except for Haredi. Haredi is another name for ultra-Orthodox, and they are exempt. This goes back to the founding of the Israeli state and when David Ben-Gurion gave exemptions for 400 yeshiva students. But today, that population has really mushroomed. It's the fastest growing part of the Israeli population. Now they make up almost 13% of the population. This issue is just a growing issue because it covers an increasingly large part of the population.
And why are they exempt? Like, what's the thinking behind it? Why this community is not asked to participate in required military service?
You know, it's interesting speaking to some, I was speaking to a Haredi on Friday who was arguing that studying the Torah is just as important for Israel as serving in the military. And they really see it that way. They see religious study as also an important way to support the state and an essential part of their way of life, and they can't do that while being in the military.
So it sounds like this has been, in some ways, a controversial issue for a while, or an issue that has come up over the years in Israel of whether or not this exemption should be continued to be allowed. But then, you know, obviously you have this moment where this question has become much more urgent. Israel has been at war with Hamas for nearly 6 months at this point. And given that, how are these exemptions viewed by Israelis now?
Yeah, well, it's become much more controversial. As you said, this issue's been going on for a long time. It's something that Netanyahu has kicked down the road. The Supreme Court ruled that these exemptions were illegal back in, unconstitutional back in 2017. But we still haven't had a new law. The government's been trying to put together a new law to figure out this issue. And the deadline basically expires today. So the expiration of this deadline comes in the middle of the war with Hamas. And people are seeing their sons die in Gaza, fight in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And it's become so much more of an emotive issue for Israelis. And there's a lot of anger around, why should some people be exempt? Why should they be safe and get to stay with their families while our children are fighting and dying for the country? It is hugely emotional right now.
Are there any numbers on that, like polls around what Israelis think about these exemptions?
Yes. There's a recent poll by the Israel Democracy Institute, and that found that 70% of Israeli Jews want these blanket exemptions to be lifted.
And oh, wow. 70% is a lot.
70%. And obviously the only segment of society that sort of wants them to stay is the Haredim themselves. Within that, the majority of ultra-Orthodox Israelis would like to see these exemptions stay, but a lot of the rest of society, yes, would want them to go.
So tell me about the position that this puts Prime Minister Netanyahu in, because my understanding is that part of the reason why he has maintained such a kind of strong support to his leadership is because of the conservative communities in Israel, the ultra-Orthodox community, that's a big part of his base. And so, like, how is he kind of navigating this moment, considering that this is an issue that affects the people who support him the most?
I mean, it's not so much that they are part of his base, because generally the ultra-Orthodox will vote for the ultra-Orthodox parties. Mm-hmm. So they won't necessarily vote for Netanyahu, but he relies on those parties for his coalition. And those voters are hugely frustrated with their representatives, because they see it as kind of one of the main things that they were charged with doing, is ensuring the protection of their status in this way. And he has to try and keep them in the coalition while also keeping other parts of his coalition together, where you have the far right, and an increasing number of far right voters are frustrated with this exemption for the Haredi. So it's this balancing act, and it's something that he's been grappling with for a long time.
Has he said anything about this, like where he lands on this issue?
So what Netanyahu has said is that if the ultra-Orthodox parties are to bring down the government now and pull out of the coalition and trigger new elections, that the winner from that would be Hamas.
הם ישתקו את המסע ומתן לשחרור חטופנו, הם יביאו לסיום המלחמה לפני השלמת יעדיה. והראשון שיברך על כך יהיה החמאס, וזה אומר הכל.
He's very critical of that move. Some might say he's very critical of that move because he's deeply unpopular right now among the Israeli public. People blame him for October the 7th. It shattered his security credentials. So he absolutely does not want elections at this moment. So it's really not in his favor politically.
And what is the outlook on whether there might be any kind of immediate action to try to get another law in place that would have these exemptions continue? Like, how quickly are they planning to resolve this issue, or maybe not resolve it?
So the Attorney General has said, you have to put in regulations and sort of ways right now to enlist the Haredim. Like, this should begin now. But they do have time to kind of make those plans. And while they're making those plans, there's going to be a lot of negotiating going on in the background to try and come to a political solution for this. I think it's less of an ideological issue for Netanyahu. It's a matter, like with many things with him, it's a matter of his political survival. So he has promised the ultra-Orthodox parties that he would find a solution to this because it was ruled in 2017 as unconstitutional that they were not being drafted. And he's also trying to satisfy these parties that he's relying on.
After the break, Loveday explains how Netanyahu has been responding to broader criticisms of his leadership from Israeli citizens and from world leaders. We'll be right back. So, Loveday, let's talk about the protests that we've seen in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. Over the weekend, tens of thousands of people flooded the streets. Tell me a little bit about what these protesters are demanding, why they are out there in such enormous numbers.
Yeah, well, in many ways, it's a return to the situation we saw before October the 7th, where we had these huge weekly protests against Netanyahu's judicial reforms, which were very controversial, and just generally anti-government protests. And today, yeah, we have people who don't think Netanyahu should be in power, that they want to see elections. He's very unpopular post October the 7th. And there's a range of issues. We also had the ultra-Orthodox out demonstrating, so, and people that want the hostages home. So there's a huge range of people out, but still not really at the numbers that we saw pre-October the 7th. Because I think there still is this feeling within much of Israeli society is, you know, this is not the time. We're in the middle of a war. And we'll deal with these issues after we've dealt with Hamas.
I want to specifically talk about the people who are protesting how the government is handling the hostage situation. Tell me more about their concerns and frustrations at this moment.
Yeah, well, this has become a real fault line within Israel, a very kind of polarizing issue. I mean, everyone wants the hostages home. It's a question of what you do to achieve that. So, yeah, I mean, the hostage families obviously are kind of at the forefront of that movement to bring their loved ones home and want to see a ceasefire deal. We have talks going on in Qatar between Israel and Hamas to try and bring those hostages home. Then you have other people who think that pressing forward with the war and through that bringing more pressure on Hamas and that military pressure will benefit getting the hostages home also.
Interesting. So it sounds like the tension here is not about like how hard the government should be fighting to get these hostages home, because you know, clearly that's, I think, a uniting issue for everyone in Israel. But the question of like, should you do it through just agreeing to a ceasefire and like letting Hamas get a little bit of what they want so that you can get these people back, or you do it through like continued fighting on the ground and through the military?
Yeah, exactly. And it's become a real sort of left-right issue. Now, I think increasingly it's seen as, oh, if you prioritize a ceasefire and getting the hostages home, that, you know, your left wing, it's become a little bit of a left-right divide in a way on that.
And then it sounds like these protests are coming at a time when Israel is also getting a lot of pressure from the outside, from the U.S. and other world leaders who have started to push back against how Israel has been navigating this war. Can you talk a little bit about that international pressure and what we've heard from other world leaders?
Sure. I mean, obviously, there's huge pressure coming from the U.S. right now, and the U.S. would like to see a ceasefire deal happen in Doha and have explicitly warned Netanyahu over a new offensive in Rafah. There's huge concern around that. But Netanyahu, in a way, is kind of playing this to his advantage in some ways. I mean, he's kind of pushing back in America and kind of, you know, we will continue till victory against Hamas. And in some ways, that's an advantage to him and Israel that is pretty united about finishing the job as they see it in Gaza.
Hmm. It sounds almost like an us against the world kind of framing, that when you have this other powerful country speaking out against you, it's like an argument for Israel to be united behind Netanyahu and not to, like, kind of show internal divisions publicly.
I mean, there are internal divisions, but I think a lot of Israelis would say it's not the U.S.'s place to tell them how to wage this war. So in that way, Netanyahu can kind of spin it, and sort of pushing back at the U.S. is sort of a way he's portraying himself as being strong and taking Israel's needs at this time into account.
There have been many moments over the past few months, over the past few years, where it has felt like, oh, this might be a moment where Netanyahu's leadership really faces an existential threat. Or, you know, maybe this is the moment where he is going to get kicked out of office. But it seems like he survives every time, that every time there is a pretty intense pushback to his leadership, that he gets through it, that he knows how to survive politically. So I'm curious, like, what do you think is going to happen in this moment? And does it have the potential to bring down Netanyahu as prime minister?
Well, I think we all know from experience that it's a mistake to write him off. He's an incredible political maneuverer. And particularly when it comes to kind of navigating these fractures within these sort of disparate coalition governments that he forms, and he always seems to find a way to cut a deal or a bargain to bring people back together. I think what we have to remember at this point is that a lot of the parties in the coalition really don't have an interest in going to elections right now. The Haredi parties, they have a lot to gain out of staying in government. They wield a lot of power right now within this government. They can demand, obviously it's not going swimmingly for them right now, but they do have a lot of leverage because they can threaten to pull out and bring down the government. There's no mm-hmm. guarantee if there were elections that they'd get back into government. They'd be outside and wielding much less leverage.
So as you continue to follow this story, what signs are you going to be looking for to understand, like, where this is all headed?
It could change at any minute. You know, it these parties, one of them could pull out and bring about an end to the government. It's really hard to predict, and it could happen in an instant, or we could see this wrangling go on and this sort of issue being kicked further down the road, as it has been for years now.
Love Day, thank you so much for explaining all this. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
Love Day Morris is a foreign correspondent for The Post. Today, I'm also keeping my eye on a couple other pieces of news. In Baltimore, efforts are continuing to clear debris from the collapsed Key Bridge. And officials there are trying to put pressure on Congress to approve relief funds to reopen the port and rebuild the bridge. They're arguing that this isn't just for the sake of Baltimore. On Sunday, Maryland Governor Wes Moore appeared on MSNBC to talk about this.
Don't support this because you think you're doing Maryland a favor. We don't need favors. Understand what this means to all the other workers and all the other small businesses all around the country. This is not just impacting Maryland. This is impacting the farm worker in Kentucky because the largest producer, the largest port for agricultural equipment is the Port of Baltimore. This is impacting the auto dealer in Ohio because the largest port for new cars, for heavy trucks, is the Port of Baltimore.
Meanwhile, officials are preparing to open an alternate channel near the collapsed bridge. It could be an important first step toward reopening the port. And if you've ever had the chance to drive along California's iconic Highway 1, this news is going to hurt. Over the weekend, a chunk of the highway near Big Sur fell down a cliff and into the ocean. You should check out the pictures. It's like something took a huge bite out of the southbound lane. About 1,600 people were stranded, and today, a 40-mile stretch of the highway is closed. Highway 1 is vulnerable to extreme weather and climate change. So this latest washout is raising more questions about the future of the highway. And, as one of our colleagues put it, quote, the engineering folly of a road built on sheer cliffs. That is it for Post Reports. Thanks for listening. Today's show was produced by Ariel Plotnick with help from Bishop Sand. It was mixed by Sean Carter and edited by Lucy Perkins. Thank you also to Jesse Messner-Hage. If you want to support the show, please subscribe to The Washington Post. It is a great way to help us continue to do this work. And you can now get access to Washington Post podcasts ad-free in Apple Podcasts. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or by following the link in our show notes. I'm Martine Powers. We'll be back tomorrow with more stories from The Washington Post.